I think we're actually still morning. I apologize. Good morning. This the next case we have is Castillo and Mr. Plofchan and Mr. Murphy. Mr. Plofchan, Mr. Murphy, have you both signed in?
I have, Your Honor.
All right. Counsel, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
Like 3 minutes, Your Honor.
All righty. And counsel, you may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Tom Plofchan. I hail from Loudoun County. I represent Braulio Castillo. We have 20,000 pages of record, 200 pages of brief, and 10 assignments of error, and I have 12 minutes. So here we go. First, I'd like to talk about is the misjoinder issue. As we've noted in our brief, there was a misjoinder in this case that requires reversal. As the court is well aware, the Court of Appeals decided the Hairston case last April. Judge Malbeau, you were on that panel. And we went through the entire, in that opinion that was written, you went through the entire standard. The generally proof tending to show an accused committed other crimes at other times is incompetent and inadmissible for the purpose of showing commission of a particular crime charged. In this particular case, especially in closing, the Commonwealth argued, to find him not guilty of murder, you have to ignore the protective order and the past abuse. This is unspecified abuse from against a specific unspecified person at an unspecified time. But 18 times in closing argument, the Commonwealth argues that we have to talk about past abuse from a protective order. The assignment of error deals with two assignments of error. One, it was improper to join, and that it was improper to admit the protective order in this particular case because of that lack of specificity. That lack of specificity focuses on or invites the jury to speculate. What was the abuse? Who was the alleged victim of the abuse? When did it occur and how it was related? Absolutely no exception is identified in the Hairston case applies in this case, and the undue prejudice is very clear. The exceptions, there's no evidence to prove modus or motive to commit the crime as charged. Unspecified abuse 2 years ago or a year and a half ago doesn't establish any motive to commit murder or entering without breaking. It doesn't establish guilty knowledge, negate the possibility of mistake or accident, show any conduct or feeling toward the accused or his victim, establish any prior relations, or prove opportunity. There's no exception that would allow for the admission of these prior bad acts, and as a consequence, under the law, Rule 3A:10 as well as Rule 3A:6, the admission was is error, cannot be deemed harmless in this case, and it was error because justice required misjoinder in this case. It required severance in this case, and was proper to join.
The next issue. I know you've got a brief amount of time. I'm going to ask you to focus on the cadaver dogs. Let me ask you this question. In terms of the cadaver dogs, why wouldn't the cases of Epperle or Pelletier be guiding and binding on this court in terms of how we look at the admissibility of that evidence as well as the handlers?
Well, the problem with it is that it's the evidence in terms of the scientific reliability as identified by the experts is different than the other two cases because this isn't a tracking dog case.
But why isn't it analogous? Because essentially we're talking about similar types of things. We're talking about the training, the reading the cues, and whether the individual dogs are reliable in terms of their past performance. Why would those situations not be analogous?
We're not because what is it probative of, Your Honor? I'll ask that question. For it to be admissible, it has to be probative of something. The trial judge already found in his order, he originally found that it is not probative of the ability to find that someone died in a particular location.
Well, and then he said in his order. Supposed to do that.
Pardon?
Dog wasn't supposed to do that.
Well, that's what it was argued, and that's what the purpose from the Commonwealth is how it was argued. It was argued that because the dog alerted in the bedroom and the dog doesn't miss, she died in the bedroom, and that was the only evidence they had that Mrs. Castillo was allegedly in the bedroom when she died, and that's the whole theory of their case.
What about the blood? Wasn't there blood found on the pillow?
Well, this court decided Jennings a year or so ago, and the blood, there's no evidence to support when the blood got there. It's what Judge Humphrey specifically said, the presence of alleged blood or DNA without foundation, which establishes when it was there, or a foundation that it didn't exist prior to a particular instance, just allows for pure speculation.
But that's something that's alone. How do we consider it if you're considering that in tandem with the cadaver dog or the finding or hit, or however you want to phrase it, in that room.
The Commonwealth can't rise above its own evidence. And in this particular case, they asked both Stockholm and Grimes, what did the dog alert to? I don't know. What was the source of what the dog alerted to? I don't know. When did that source arrive there? I don't know.
But how is that different than Epperly? How is that different than Epperly when they essentially said sort of the same types of things? I can't tell you why the dog is alerting. I can't tell you exactly how it works in terms of the alerting. I can only tell you sort of the reliability.
The purpose is, the issue, are what is the purpose of the evidence? If you have evidence that is supposed to be supportive of investigative tools, then it could be a basis for a search warrant. There could be an issue with regard to it being in some way aiding an investigation. But the way it was used in this case was to provide proof the proof.
Just like in Epperly.
Well, except no, that this in this case, Your Honor, it's that it's in Epperly, it was corroborative of other evidence that was the proof. This is the evidence that she wants to then use other things, the Commonwealth wanted to use other things to corroborate. This becomes the central evidence in this case. It's not corroborative of other evidence. What, there is no evidence that...
Your client's blood and DNA in the bedroom isn't central evidence in the case?
If it invites speculation, and there's no evidence that the dog focused on DNA in the bedroom, Your Honor.
Well, we're not talking about the dog.
Okay.
It's undisputed, is it not, that your client's DNA and blood was found in the bedroom?
It's also undisputed he lived there for 8 years. And under Jennings...
So presumably it was deposited before entry of the protective order?
Yes, Your Honor. In Jennings, the court said unless you can establish when it was deposited, because DNA doesn't go away. The adage in terms of the DNA expert says, just because at Ford's Theater, Abraham Lincoln's DNA is in his chair, doesn't mean he was there last week. DNA doesn't go away. And with the Commonwealth doesn't establish, as required under Jennings, the foundational requirement of the timing of the presence of blood or DNA, then all you're doing is inviting the jury to speculate with respect
to it. On another subject, what's your argument on your assignment of error 7? If you wish to argue something else.
Your Honor, I'm here at your discretion. So, as I said, I had 12. The right to remain silent. The argument on the Commonwealth that it was permissible is that on the right to remain silent, that they were able to comment on his silence, was that that was some inference of guilt. The problem with it, as the court has said and we've cited in our brief, there's no legal foundation for that inference. There is not a guaranteed or recognized response when someone learns that someone they're close to dies. And so if the Commonwealth can't meet the burden of proving that the response is inferential of guilt and not inferential of innocence, then it's not admissible because it's not probative.
But doesn't it really go to weight of the evidence as opposed to admissibility? In other words, in context, it's up to the trier of fact to make a determination about what that really means.
Actually, Your Honor, I'll take issue with that question if you don't mind. In Croson, the court decided that no, and this goes back to like 1957, has guided our principles on admissibility. There's not just some bold discretion on the part of a trial court to say, I'm going to admit something and let it go to weight. The admission of evidence is associated with legal principles. And the legal principles, for it to be admitted, it has to be probative. More likely than not, a particular fact. In this particular case, you can't say to a jury, oh, it comes in and you decide if it's inferential of something.
Well, you base this on a constitutional basis. Do you not?
Well, I think we argue it both constitutional, yes, and we say it's a de novo.
Are you aware of any case in which silence was held inadmissible that was not the result of a question by a police officer?
Your Honor, actually, I'm relying on, and when we talk constitution, we mentioned Section A of the Virginia Constitution, and we cited Dean v. Commonwealth, and one of the issues was that if someone's reliance on their protected rights under the Virginia Constitution, they have, the court is loath to draw these inferences against them, and that was the basis in the brief with respect to our discussion on that.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Yes, ma'am.
If for this to actually be something that would be protected under the Sixth Amendment, either through the U.S. Constitution or Virginia Constitution, has to be some type of speech. And even though an act that is silent can be, in fact, that, is simply a showing of emotion communicating something that would be covered.
Well, the issue on it is that it's a subjective analysis of emotion, but it is silence. And it's not saying, oh, he had a grin and so forth. It was he didn't react, he didn't speak. And then the problem with it is, again, goes to the inference that is what is suggested for the jury to draw from that.
But
and it's an inference of guilt.
The statement from McCafferty was that there was no emotion. So I know I'm parsing, and I'm being very specific for a reason, because we have to characterize it as something, right?
Sure.
So either it's going to be speech or something that's not speech. If he's characterizing it specifically as emotion, he showed no emotion as opposed to he remained silent. How does that impact your argument?
Well, I think emotion can be speech. If I, am I communicating, that was such a good question, Judge. Oh, of course I'm communicating. I don't say anything. But my emotion on my face might communicate something along those lines. For him to say there is no emotion is commenting on his silence, his communication, in which there's no prescribed proper way to communicate. I can't look at anyone and say, if I learn that someone very close to me dies and I sit down and I cry, that's as a valid response. Or if I go, oh, wow, thank God they're not suffering, and I'm like, okay, finally. That neither of those are inferential of guilt, and to allow something that is not probative to be admitted just so that we'll let the jury treat it any way they want is improper admission of evidence, because it doesn't go to one issue more than the other issue in that regard. I'd like to, since there aren't any questions, I'd like to move on to the I think the more sophisticated legal argument that is the Craig v. Maryland issue with regard to confrontation.
Well, that brings up Roadcap. Tell me why that would not be impactful here.
Well, Roadcap, I think, is instructive. It's just not binding because the statute's changed. And in this particular case, the 18.267.9 has changed since Roadcap, and it's changed since Craig was decided. Because when it was decided originally, it was only for victims of child abuse, and that narrow exception was decided by the Supreme Court of the United States that said victims of child abuse, because there's a legitimate public policy for this narrow class of people, that we're going to allow them not to be confronted by their accuser. What happened was the General Assembly expanded that to anyone under the age of 12.
To include any type of victim in terms of a child victim that might witness a homicide.
Well, actually, that's not what the statute says. It says anyone under the age of 12 who is called as a witness in the case. Zachary didn't witness any homicide. He has no testimony that he witnessed any homicide. But he's a witness. Anyone else under 12 is saying you get to go to closed circuit TV. That certainly doesn't follow the exceptions with regard to Craig v. Maryland, nor does it follow the imprimatur given us by Gonzalez-Lopez or Crawford. And more importantly, it's not even consistent with Roadcap. Roadcap indicated that Roadcap was legitimate under the prior statute because there was a necessity of the evidence that the Commonwealth had to establish that any anxiety that the child had was primary.
But here?
Pardon?
I mean, so there are a couple of different things. One, there's the facial challenge as it relates to the statute. And clearly we've got a presumption that statutes are presumed to be constitutional. Let's move along, though, directly to your question or your area, which I think is an interesting one. If, in fact, we have a situation where we have the psychologist making the determinations that you're talking about in terms of whether it's going to be detrimental to Zachary or Z testifying, how does that impact what you're indicating in terms of whether the Commonwealth has put forth the necessary evidence to establish that he qualifies to testify under that statute?
Okay. Well, I guess the real question is, are we going to abide by the law or not? And if we're going to abide by the law, then the law has to be what the court has told us what the law is. And the court has told us that the law is not that someone is merely concerned by or suffers from being in the presence of the defendant, but any angst they're suffering is primarily from being exposed to the defendant. And I didn't write those words. The court did. I didn't write those words, but that's the law. And when the psychologist was asked
which case are you getting that out of?
Primarily?
Out of Roadcap or...
Yes, Your Honor, it's out of Roadcap. It's also out of Craig v. Maryland and the standards that go from that. And so if that's where it's primarily from that issue, and in our brief we actually go through how it's adopted under different circuits, and we talk about it begins with a tree bear, I think, is out of the Ninth Circuit, where they further discuss that. But it's the primary source of the angst. The counselor didn't say that. The counselor and the question to the counselor from the Commonwealth attorney was, will the child have angst from being in a court, being in front of the judge, being in front of a jury, being in front of her dad, and having to testify in public? And she says, yeah. And she didn't say, oh, he's going to have angst from that. She says, it would be in his best interest not to testify. Well, there's no evidence that the ROCAP standard was met, which is that the primary source of the angst, which is the whole basis for the public policy, the primary source of the angst is exposure to this person, and it's such an important public policy that someone's constitutional right to confrontation gets compromised. That wasn't established in this case, and the law, what the judge just said is, oh, they've changed the law, anyone under the age of 12, we get to use closed-circuit TV, and that's where my time is up.
Mr. Falkian, I'm going to give you an extra 4 minutes, but I'm going to ask you a question and let you answer, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
In terms of the question, or what you just indicated in terms of ROCAP, and you were talking also about the extension of Craig, why wouldn't this be analogous? Because if you're looking at the policy purposes behind why, let me rephrase that. If you're looking at the reason behind Craig in terms of why it was decided, there was a balancing between the confrontation clause and the potential harm it could do to the witness. And so if you're looking just at that part of the analysis in terms of the statute that we have in terms of the closed circuit TV, why isn't that applicable? Why isn't that the same balance that essentially occurred here?
Because the Supreme Court rejected it when they rejected O'Brien. When they came back with Crawford, they said the problem when we've said, oh, there can be balancing, is that judges, and all respect to judges doing their job as best they can, what they typically found was, oh, there's a sufficient reliability of the evidence, so we're going to denigrate the confrontation clause.
But it doesn't specifically overrule Craig. Correct?
Crawford
does not overrule Craig.
No, it did not.
And ROCAP specifically says that
Crawford
does not
doesn't overrule Craig, but that doesn't expand Craig. And ROCAP doesn't overrule it or expand Craig, where they said it's a specific narrow thing. And what the statute did, the statute, when they amended the statute, it expands it manifold, because it's not a victim of child abuse fronting their accuser. It's any person under the age of 12 who is testifying, no matter on what subject, in this type of trial. And in this case, I'm not asking for you to find it's unconstitutional per se as to everyone, but it's certainly unconstitutional. Well, it's unconstitutional as per Mr. Castillo, and the effects of that, I'm saying, is as applied to Mr. Castillo, it's unconstitutional because he had the right to confront this witness who had given multiple stories throughout the time. I think it is not an analogous situation saying, oh, this is a public policy the General Assembly did, because it wasn't a narrowly defined public policy with a specific purpose, only to say if you're under 12, you can do this. And they didn't address the issue. And there's no case that interprets the statute as amended now, because it's amended after ROCAP. And that's
Mr. Plofton, I'm going to give you an extra 4 minutes, as I've said.
Thank you, Your Honor. If you want to give me another 15, I take it. Thank you.
Mr. Murphy, come on up, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. I'll cover the issues covered by the appellant, and of course we'll be available for any questions on anything else. On the severance, this is a simple one, I think. I mean, this couldn't
be. Mr. Murphy, I hate to interrupt you. Let's go to the last argument, though, that Mr. Plofchan brought up in terms of the confrontation rights in reference to the closed circuit television. He's argued something very discreetly, which is essentially that Craig, while addressing the constitutionality of allowing a child victim to testify in a case where he or she is actually the victim, that is the exception to which Craig has said that that's permissible. But here we have a situation where it is expanded beyond what Craig said and beyond what ROCAP said, and that it's a different premise.
First of all, this sounds very new to me. I'm not sure this is an argument in the brief, but it seems to me once the Supreme Court determines that you can do this for particular situations, it's up to the state courts to determine how they will draft their statute. And if the statute, in fact, follows the requirements of Maryland versus Craig for this determination of who will be permitted to use this procedure, I don't think we could find that is in any way a violation of Craig.
Let me ask you this. So opposing counsel makes two basic arguments, the facial constitutionality issue and then the as-applied constitutionality issue. And the General Assembly, post-Craig, expanded the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
And ROADCAP has said that Crawford has no impact on Craig. This is sort of a nuanced thing, but is it your position that you use the same Craig analysis to the amended statute to make a determination as to its constitutionality?
Yes, Your Honor. I think what the defendant argued below and I believe on brief was that the facial unconstitutionality of the statute because Craig had been overruled by Crawford. And clearly that goes nowhere in light of ROCAP and the Johnson case in the Supreme Court, which said that we don't decide what the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court implicitly overruled one of its cases. If they don't say it, we don't go ahead and try to explain what that second case meant. So there's no way you can find that Craig has been overruled by the Supreme Court. And I think at this point, all we say is, does this case violate the principles of Craig and ROADCAP? And I don't believe that you can find it, merely because they have included another category of children who will be traumatized by testifying. In this case, the murder of the mother by the father. It seems to me if that issue were to come up, the judges who would consider Craig to make sense would certainly say, in this case also, it is important that we protect the child from serious traumatic harm, which Ms. Spoon testified would occur in the testimony in live court with the defendant present.
And nothing in Craig or its progeny suggests that it is limited precisely to the child victim.
No, Your Honor. I think even, we are talking about somebody who is in effect a victim. The fact that the father has killed the mother. And this is not somebody who observed a murder by a stranger. This is somebody who it seems to me the legislature, as it has done in the court, would consider this is exactly what we are trying to use the statute for. Now, with respect to the severance, this was clearly an easy case because these crimes are completely intertwined. You couldn't commit the murder without getting into the house. You couldn't get into the house without committing a burglary and violating the protective order.
Your argument is that it's out of the same operative facts per the statute and so therefore admissible and allowed.
Yes, right. I mean, no question about it that these are intertwined cases and it couldn't be a clearer case for joinder.
Do you want to address the cadaver dogs?
Yes, Your Honor. On the cadaver dogs, the reliability of these dogs and these handlers has been established not only in this case, but in Lane, where the same handlers and dog Morse were found to be reliable and that was upheld on appeal. You might also notice that there's much talk in here about the dogs being bracketed. They do testing before and after the main search, and that's exactly what happened here. Morse was tested the day before the search of the Castillo home. So it's clear that the trial judge could make the finding that this was reliable. It's his call, and if the evidence supports it, and there's certainly clearly evidence supporting that finding. Now, with respect to the claim that the handlers didn't know what the dogs were finding. The experts said over and over again, I know, I'm confident that they were alerting to decomposing human flesh. It wasn't a question of whether, as they said, can you tell me what the dog is doing? And they said, well, I'm not sure what the dog's doing. And it's this thing that somehow that's supposed to mean that they don't know that the dog alerted. They said, particularly in this case, where it was clear that the dog first alerted on the basement, where there's incontestable that the victim was there, and an immediate search immediate response thereafter in the bedroom, is clearly demonstrative of the same thing. And that, I think Grimes said that, I'm confident that because he responded to this way downstairs, the response upstairs meant the same thing.
Is the standard to be applied the one used for tracking dogs or the ones used for drug dogs, or is that standard the same?
Well, I think they're analogous, as Judge Malveaux.
Analogous to which, though?
Well,
or
I mean,
to all of them?
Well, I mean, I think that basically all the question comes down to, is this testimony reliable? I mean, it's a new science. Can you provide evidence, can you provide testimony that this is something we should rely upon? And I think it's clear in this case that that was there. And the point is, additionally, when you start looking at the blood evidence, as you know, because this is important evidence, but even if it were ever to have it in, you have other solid evidence that the defendant was in the bedroom fighting with the wife from the DNA and blood. Now, don't forget, it's not just DNA on the sheets. There's blood, fresh blood, as described by the Commonwealth's attorney, in a house where there's a maid who washes the sheets, pillows, and et cetera, and pillowcases, and there's blood discovered. And the defendant has not been in that house legally for over a year. And yet somehow his blood is in the bedroom. And it seems to me that that makes it clear that, in fact, he was there and, to the extent necessary, corroborates the alert.
Because it makes the protective order relevant.
Oh, no question about that, yeah. But the cadaver dog evidence with the blood makes it clear that there was no suicide, that in fact, and that an attack occurred in the bedroom where the victim probably died. And I think that it's clear that there is no reason to doubt. No, the judge had a substantial hearing on this, a full-day hearing on this, took experts from both sides and ruled that, in fact, this is reliable evidence. And that's consistent with the cases I've cited from other states which have discussed cadaver dogs. On the right to silence, there's no constitutional problem at all because it's unlike Taylor, there is no questioning, no inference of guilt from, no tacit admission. Is this your gun, was the question in Taylor. There was no response, and that was read to be the impropriety there.
Your point is because there was no prior question.
No question, no custody, just a notification. No discussion of Miranda. So what we're talking about only is the emotional response, and we have set forth cases from other states that have decided that that is relevant. And even in this state, the rule is that any evidence having any tendency to make the existence of a fact in issue more probable, less probable. And
does the interpretation then go to weight rather than admissibility? Once you've established the threshold, okay, it's relevant.
Yes.
Then isn't it really up to the trier of fact to determine what impact to give that response?
Yes, Your Honor. In the Thomas case from Maryland, they relied upon Wigmore. And Wigmore said that the post-crime state of mind of the defendant is clearly important. And one of the things that assist you in making a determination of how relevant that is whether or not he fails to respond to something like this. His behavior immediately after the crime, I think the next day after the crime, is certainly relevant and important to the person trying to determine what his state of mind is, whether he has any consciousness of guilt. And I think that it was relevant, and I think it's clearly constitutional.
What if he had started laughing, Mr. Murphy?
Well, that would, of course, been even more determinative, it seems to me. That would have been,
and still would have been admissible.
Yes, sure. I think, any display of emotion, it's hard to say that, displaying emotion is speech, because you're not you're not compelled to laugh. You're not compelled to do nothing. I mean, the sense is that hard to say that.
But part of what constitutes speech is whether you're trying to convey something. And I
yes,
think Mr. Plofkin's point is that the silence in and of itself would be speech because that it could be interpreted as trying to convey something.
Well, I mean, the question is, it could also be interpreted as not conveying anything, and that, in fact, it is the conduct. You know, someone who breaks into laughter, it'd be hard to say that he is, unless he intentionally is mocking something, the mere fact that he's laughing, he's not compelled to laugh, not compelled to make a response or no response. He was informed, as was required, the officer had to tell him about the death of his wife. He didn't approach him in an effort to find out, as they did in Taylor, is this your gun? This is not in a situation where there's custody, questioning, or anything of that nature, and all they're permitting to come in is the statement that when I told him about notification, he didn't display any emotion.
Do you want to speak to the Brady violations?
Brady. Let's see. Oh, the
McAfee. Yeah. I know we're skipping around. I'm trying
right.
to highlight.
I think the basic point here is if you look at what we're talking about, this report.
Is this actually a Brady violation?
It's alleged as a, argued as a Brady violation, but it doesn't seem to me that anything, this allegedly false report was helpful in any way to the defendant. It's clearly inadmissible. It is both evidence of a specific act and extrinsic evidence, which is precluded by 2:608. And contrary to the defendant's argument in his reply brief, 608 has not been changed in any way by 607. In fact, if you look at Rule 2:102, it says these rules merely incorporate prior Virginia law. In any case, and do not make changes. And in fact, so 608 is still controlling law here, and in fact, it says that this kind of evidence cannot come in. The defendant argues also that, well, maybe they would have found something if they had had that evidence. They might have found other evidence. Well, the trial court addressed that issue.
But isn't there the requirement that it actually lead to it? I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be admissible. It also has to, even if it's not admissible, it has to lead to admissible evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any sort of evidence of that you're aware of?
Well, the defendant did argue that on brief. The trial court addressed that issue and determined that, and this is in 2016, pages 21 through 22, where the court said it had reviewed everything, it had reviewed and determine everything. Now, of course, there was a lot of stuff on this issue at this point, lots of exhibits, lots of argument, and he determined that the release of that document would not have produced any additional evidence, would not have made any outcome, would not have changed the outcome of the trial. So I think that the judge reviewed that and determined there just wasn't any additional evidence, certainly specified. No reason to believe that there would be additional evidence, because don't forget they'd already gone through the work records and things like that, trying to get the McAfee work records, which in fact showed that he had been an admirable employee, and the only reason he was fired was a political change of regimes at the sheriff's office. And for those reasons, I would request that the decision below be affirmed, unless there are any further questions from the court.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Plofkin?
I'd like to start, Judge Decker, you asked a question about road cap and you also asked a question about Craig. And I point, Craig quoting says, establish an exception to, quote, a physical face-to-face confrontation at trial only where denial of such confrontation is necessary to further an important public policy and only where the reliability of the testimony is otherwise assured.
Okay, stop a minute.
Yes, ma'am.
Important public policy. Who makes public policy? The General Assembly.
Well, they further, they do. But they further clarified it.
Okay.
Because you asked, well, did they limit it?
Go
and
ahead.
Then they further clarified it and said, the Supreme Court said, a state's interest in the physical and psychological well-being of child abuse victims may be sufficiently important to outweigh, at least in some cases, a defendant's right to confrontation. It was a narrow holding to the decision which of Maryland law, which paralleled Virginia law at that time.
Right. So basically the way that reads is it's a public policy decision, and certain public policy decisions may give rise to this added protection.
I can accept that.
In that instance, it was the child sex victim.
Right. Certain policies may, but the Commonwealth hasn't established that the modification of the statute when it's broad prohibition against any witness follows into that may category, because may also implies may not. And based on the interpretation of confrontation with subsequent cases like Gonzalez-Lopez and Crawford, it's our position that the expanded statute doesn't. The court also asked a question with regard to road cap.
Was that actually preserved? Mr. Murphy indicates that in the lower court, the specific argument that you're making, that the constitutionality of the statute being expanded and not having road cap or Craig be applicable, was not necessarily something that was specifically argued.
I think the argument was that road cap, the argument that was preserved was it was a denial of confrontation, which this is what this is.
It was
a denial of confrontation.
As well as applied, but but this is a more nuanced argument.
I believe it's covered, Your Honor, in terms of the other exemptions with regard to the briefing that was done in the particular case. I will tell you that
briefing down below.
Okay. Trial counsel, I don't know that would articulate using my words in it. Okay. Frankly, I don't remember sometimes my own words. But in this case, but I think it was covered. I want to address one other issue with regard to road cap, because you asked me specifically what the findings were, and it's found on page 57 of the appellant's brief. It requires road cap requires a requisite finding of necessity, and that necessity must be case-specific. The child must be traumatized not by the courtroom generally, but primarily by the presence of the defendant, and emotional distress suffered by the witness must be more than nervousness, excitement, or reluctance to testify. And that was the standard in road cap. And our argument is both under road cap, the standard wasn't met, because there's not this issue of being primarily traumatized by the presence of the defendant, as well as the fact that Craig has the expanded statute brings us to something brand new. I also wanted to focus as well as the cadaver dogs, because I think it's when I was listening to Mr. Murphy's argument, I don't think that there's a fundamental distinction that I think has to be made with cadaver dogs. One is that the court didn't find cadaver dogs reliable. The court in its May order prior to allowing the testimony, and this is when we argued in our brief that they actually shifted the burden. They said evidence can come in because we didn't prove it shouldn't come in. But he said that the dog is not reliable for finding a specific body in a specific location. And the Commonwealth said it wasn't going to be used for that. Therefore, we're going to allow them to use this cadaver dog evidence. That's exactly what the Commonwealth used it for. They said because the body was in the bedroom and the dog alerted in the bedroom, that's the proof that that's where the body was located. So the court found that it wasn't reliable for exactly what the Commonwealth used it for, and then they argued 18 times or as many times as they argued in closing that the dog never misses and the dog never misses.
And that was all objected to.
Mr. Plotkin, I'm going to allow you to – well, you just answered Judge Decker's question. I'm sorry, but your time is concluded. It goes by very quickly. We're going to come down.